Today we begin a new series, and it's called Speaking the Truth in Love to Mormons. I want to point out from the very beginning what our goal of this class is. It is not just to learn what the Mormon Church believes and teaches. The main goal of this class is to help you in interacting with Mormon people and to witness to them about the gospel. The book that I will be using in the class has the same name. I copied it. It's called Speaking the Truth in Love to Mormons. It's written by a Wells pastor who has lived for several decades in Mormon country. He's from Nampa, Idaho. And he's done a lot of work with Mormons, reaching out to them in his community. And he's put together some of the things that he's learned about Mormonism. I copied the table of contents for you. I did not order enough copies for everyone because I didn't know how many to expect. But I'm going to pass around the sign-up sheet, and on that sheet you'll be able to check if you would like to purchase one of the books. Then we'll just order them, a large shipment of them from Northwestern, and hopefully by next Sunday you'll be able to have your copy of the book. Kathy tells me to expect something like about $20 per book. You don't have to have the money today, however. Shipping, we know this, is really high with the price of gas. So I apologize about the cost. But on the little packet that I've made, you will see the different chapters we will be going through. I will hand out a copy. Well, no, you have it already. You have a copy of chapter 1 to do the homework for next time. There's a study guide that goes with it as you read it. And that first chapter is entitled, Know Their Goals. Notice, this is a book that's made up of two parts. The first one is Know Mormons. So the first six chapters, we will be simply studying what do they believe, what do they teach. And then you can see the second part of the course will be Reach Mormons. How do you reach out to them? How do you talk with them? You're going to find, you're going to see in the book a little dictionary in the back that this pastor calls it Mormonese. Learn to understand what the meanings of religious terms are to a Mormon so that you don't end up talking past them. When they're talking about something like exaltation, they have a little bit different meaning to that word than we would have. And this book will be helpful to you in understanding their ways of thinking so that when it comes to you wanting to witness to them, you won't just be talking past them, but you'll be able better to speak their language. The second half of the book and of the course, then, talks about reaching Mormons, beginning with chapter 7. Reach Mormons with the power of God's word. Reach Mormons with the hard-hitting law. Chapter 9. Reach Mormons with the sweet gospel. 10. Reach Mormons with love. Reach Mormons with attention to their arguments. Reach Mormon missionaries. Reach Mormons and keep them. Okay? Just wanted to give you a little overview of all the topics we'll be discussing in the course. And then, of course, you see the rest of that packet is the first chapter. This is something that I'd like to ask you to read during the week. You know how I handle homework. I strongly encourage it. But if you don't do it, I'm not going to pick on you or anything. You'll still get benefits from attending the class regularly, but you won't get as much as if you did the homework. The other sheet, the single sheet, has two sides, and the side that says Speaking the Truth in Love to Mormons, worksheet number 1, that's what you'll fill out as you study the chapter. And that sheet will serve as the basis for our discussion. If you've been in my Bible classes for very long, you know how I handle things like questions. They're simply discussion starters, something to get you thinking and to keep us focused. The questions go very much along with the pages of the chapter. You'll find them rather easy to do. let me go back to the title, Speaking the Truth in Love to Mormons. Anybody know what book of the Bible that phrase comes from? Speak the truth in love. From the book of Ephesians. There the Apostle Paul encourages us to be that way with one another. That we're always seeking the truth to our fellow believers, but we're doing it in love, he says. We have to keep both things in mind. We speak the truth of God's word uncompromisingly, but we do it out of love. Not to tear someone else down or to make them feel unnecessarily bad about themselves. We do it in love for their good. To get them turned around from the sin that perhaps they're engaged in at the time or the wrong path that they're walking down. We do it in order to restore them. And this course is going to be done in the same way. We're going to have those two prongs to our theme. We are going to seek the truth uncompromisingly, but we're going to do it in a spirit of love. Simply for the winning of souls. Speaking the truth in love to Mormons. I'll pass around, maybe I'll even pass the book around too, so you can take a look at it today, and that may help you to decide if you want to order it or not. Here's the sign-up sheet. Please sign your name on the left, and then on the right, just put a check mark or something, or a number of copies you want for your couple or family. And I'll order them first thing Monday morning, and hopefully the shipment will be here then by next Sunday. Okay, that's it for housekeeping details and setting the theme. Does anybody have any questions to begin with? Any comments? This course will run throughout the summer then. I believe the last Sunday in August will be our last Sunday. There'll be a couple of these weeks where you have to take two chapters in the book, but there are several chapters that are rather small. Norma? If it's the same title, this is by the same author. I believe this is a second edition that I have here, or an updated edition, if the cover looks different to you. If it's the same name, it should be the same book. Only, I've noticed it has been updated, this version as compared to the one in the library. But there are many books. It's a much written about topic. Rich?
Did you read a paper the other day where they have an open house at the New Mormon Temple?
Yes. Sacramento is getting a Mormon temple this summer, and if you know anything about temples, those of us who are not Mormon cannot enter them. Except when they're being built, there is a time where the community is invited to come and see the temple. And Galen had emailed me a couple of weeks ago and told me the dates. It's, I believe, July 29th is the day that it'll be open to the public, and then it goes to something like August 27th. So you have about a month where you could go visit it. It's near Aerojet, if you haven't seen it yet. I haven't seen it since any building started. It was just vacant land, but I knew about their plans. So if you'd like to see a Mormon temple, that's your chance to do it.
$15
a ticket, Paul. So don't expect to get in for free. Okay, then today will simply be an introduction to Mormonism. It's the back side of the worksheet. The one entitled, Speaking the Truth in Love to Mormons at our church, dated June 18. Important dates in the development of Mormonism. Joe? Oh, the paper says free.
Well,
you'll have to check it out yourself. I don't want to become a salesman for them anyway. Okay. Okay, Mormonism began in the early 1800s, and it is important for us to understand the religious environment that it grew out of. In America, there have been two periods called Great Awakenings that really kind of shaped the Christian religion in America early in its history. The first Great Awakening took place in the 1700s, before the Revolution. The second one took place in the early 1800s. And the key thing about these awakenings were revivals. Meetings of Christians out somewhere in nature, often in a tent, where a fire and brimstone pastor preached for long periods of time. The discussion was often about end times. The 1800s was just fascinating with what was going to happen in the end times. A man by the name of Schofield, at the beginning of the early 1800s, came up with a study Bible in which he interpreted many of the end time prophecies in a very unique way. To my knowledge, he is the first one who began speaking about the rapture and many of the other aspects of what is called millennialism. That there will be a 1,000-year reign, earthly reign, Jesus on the earth. End times were a big topic of discussion, and it is that particular topic that got many of the Native American religions, and I don't mean Native in the sense of the Natives that were here, but the religions that have been spawned here in America have mostly come about because of the question of millennialism. Jehovah's Witnesses, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Mormons, were all deeply influenced in their early history by the teaching of millennialism. As a matter of fact, the Seventh-day Adventists, the first leader was the one who predicted, I forget which day it was, in 1843 that Jesus was going to come again. And they all gathered around and Jesus didn't come. And then he said, oops, I meant 1844. And then they waited another year and no Jesus. This was a big topic in these revivals of the Great Awakening. But the Second Great Awakening was also very much, one of the characteristics of it were the manifestations of the Spirit that Americans have often looked for. There were people who would come to these services and begin barking like a dog, or falling on the floor and beginning to shake. A large part of it, too, was the teaching that I have to be brought to that point where the Holy Spirit really shakes me up and really gets me. They used to have something called the anxious bench that people would sit on, and it was anxious because those were the ones that really had to think about their sins. And were they really sorry for their sins? And it was out of this environment that Mormonism came. Another key element of the Second Great Awakening was the idea that you could get revelations that went above and beyond what the Bible said. And that's probably the key thing we're going to see in our history that we have today. That Joseph Smith believed that he often had visits from God the Father, God the Son, by some saint or some angel who gave him a new revelation that the church, the organized church, was an evil place. Early in the revelations, he was told not to join any organized church because none of them were right. He, as you can see from your outline there, he began getting revelations when he was only 15. He was born in Vermont in 1805. His family moved when he was still a boy to upstate. upstate New York, and he experienced these revivals and this great fervency of religion that was going on. There were so many revivals in this area that since that time, it has been known as the Burnt Over District. I understand that it's not a particularly religious area anymore, because it seems that all these revivals kind of burned the people out. But it was in Palmyra, New York, near Rochester, way in the west, not too far from Buffalo, that he began to get these revelations. First, the Father and the Son came and spoke with him. And gradually he got more and more of these revelations. There was a time in 1823 when he was told that there were special plates hidden in the area. It was not yet ready for these plates to be revealed to him, but a time would come when he could see the plates. But he had to wait for 4 years. It was not until 1827 that the angel Moroni came to him one night and finally entrusted him with the golden plates. He claimed later on that they were covered with a language. The writing on them was written in something called Reformed Egyptian. And the angel allowed him to keep the plates for a time and to translate them. He let some people know about this. He had helpers along the way. At first, his wife served as his secretary. And he claimed that with them came two stones called the Urim and the Thummim. Perhaps some of you remember from your Old Testament study that the priests of the Old Testament had a Urim and a Thummim, which were two stones that were placed in the breastplate that the priests would wear, and they were sometimes used for determining an answer that God would give. We don't know exactly how they worked back in Old Testament times. Some people have proposed perhaps they were like a yes or a no, depending on which one the priest pulled out of the breastplate, the pocket in the breastplate. But in any case, Joseph Smith, who knows the scriptures very well, begins to take concepts like this and begins to use them for his own purposes, believing that God has given him a revelation, that he should be a special priest of God. And he takes these two stones, the Urim and the Thummim, and he begins to look at them. They seem to have been almost like something that maybe he thought he saw through onto the plates, so that he would be able to interpret them. But there are various accounts of this. We're not exactly sure how he claimed to see the interpretation of the plates. Some people think it's that once he looked through the stones, he actually saw the words there in English and then could just read them, and his secretary would write down the words. But there are other explanations for it too, that just as he was looking through the stones and looking at the plates, that the revelation came to him of what was on it. His wife, who served as the first secretary, said that whenever he would look at the plates, they were covered over with a cloth anyway. So it doesn't seem like he was actually looking at the characters that were on them. But over a period of a little less than 3 years, he translated these into English. They are what is called the Book of Mormon. He had difficulty getting it printed because he was always a very controversial character within the community. There were always people who were questioning, what is this revelation that you're getting? All this talk about him being a prophet, or at a certain point he felt that he was the first priest in this new church that he was starting. He had a friend by the name, I think the friend's name was Oliver Cawdrey, and at a certain point, they baptized one another, and then they were part of the priesthood of this new church. And he said there were two levels of priesthood. The younger men, and the more common form of priesthood, I believe, was the Aaronic
priesthood, but he had a special one. He was of the priesthood of Melchizedek. And about the time that the book was printed, the church was officially incorporated. You have the date there on your outline. It was on April 6th, 1830, that this church was officially incorporated in the state of New York. Maybe let's take a little bit of a look at the Book of Mormon, its contents, while we're talking about this too. The Book of Mormon is a fascinating book. I only started reading it. I'm into the 60s of it. When I took it off my shelf, I realized how short really it is. I would encourage you, if you have a copy of it, to try reading it over the course of this class. My copy of it is only a little over 500 pages, and it's got a lot of footnotes in the bottom. So it's rather brief. It's certainly not as long as the Old Testament or something like that. But it's a book that's made to look very much like the Bible. It really isn't one book per se. It's 15 books. Kind of like in our Old Testament and our New Testament, we have different books. But all of these books, of course, were translated by Joseph Smith and came to him through the special tablets that he believed that he received. When you look at it, and if you would compare it to your King James Version of the Bible, which you probably still have, it looks very similar. It's printed out the same way. Remember how the verses used to be printed as separate little paragraphs, each one maybe in two columns? It's printed just like that. And amazingly, it has the exact same language as the King James Version. The verses often begin with, "And it came to pass." And it's full of all the these and thous that were used back in King James' day, but oddly enough, was a different kind of English than was spoken in Joseph Smith's day. People who have studied it have found thousands of places. I think the figures I read yesterday were there are 25,000 words that seem to be taken directly from the Old Testament, King James Version of the Bible, and about 2,000 that are taken from the New Testament. Oftentimes, even if there's a phrase that's very reminiscent of something in the King James Bible, it's clearly altered just slightly so it doesn't look like it's taken lock, stock, and barrel out of the King James. But there are certain chapters where the heading, you always have the heading, kind of like our King James Versions often had on each chapter. And in that heading, he will even say, compare Isaiah 48 to this chapter. And you will see that it flows quite nicely along with chapter 48 of Isaiah. It is filled with a story about how the Jewish people, a remnant Jewish people, came to America. It is a very America-centered story. There are three groups of people, supposedly, that came to America from the Middle East. The first group came way back at the time of the Tower of Babel. I believe those are the ones who are called the Jaredites. When God confused all the languages and the people had to spread out all over the earth, the Book of Mormon claims to trace that one group who gets all the way to America. The book begins, the section that I've been reading, begins with a group that comes in the 500s B.C. If any of you were in my Old Testament class, you know we got as far as the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians in 586 B.C. Just before that destruction of America, of Babylon, a man by the name of Lehi leads his family out of Jerusalem and stays in the wilderness for a time, but eventually builds a ship in which the entire family sails to America. There is one other group of people who come to America in this BC period, and these are the ancestors of the American Indians. There is a whole series of wars and things that take place where many of the good people among those remnants of Jews are killed off. And the American Indians that are left kind of forget the whole background of where they come from. And so when Christopher Columbus discovers America, there's nothing of this civilization left. Joseph Smith was, however, very fascinated with things like Indian mounds. There were Indian mounds, burial mounds in New York, and he kind of imagined how the remnants of a certain battle may have been a whole heap of people, and they just kind of covered it up, and then he would explain, and that's how that particular mound came into being. It's very much a story of America, if you're familiar enough with it. Part of the Book of Mormon also says that Jesus, in the 3 days between his death and his resurrection, came to America and preached to the people who were in America. It seems to take many of the parts of the Bible and want to give it a connection with America. Mormonism is very much an American religion. I looked yesterday for these next two facts and was not able to find where I'd read these before. I don't think they come from the Book of Mormon. But there is a Mormon claim even that the... Now, I said I'd make sure I get them straight, which one is which. I believe the Garden of Eden was in Kansas, Missouri, somewhere around there, according to Mormon belief. And Noah built the Ark in North Carolina. So there's this strong attachment trying to bring all the biblical events into an American setting. Some people have theorized and wondered, evidently there was some type of author who lived before Joseph Smith who wrote some type of fictional account like this, and they've wondered if maybe that's where he first got the idea. Or exactly, you know, where it comes from. It's a very mysterious beginning. Joseph Smith was known even before making these religious revelations to have been a treasure seeker. That he and a group of friends were always digging in the ground and trying to find things that were like buried treasure. There have also been people who have claimed that he was involved in the occult at a certain point in time, and that some of the teachings of the occult kind of influenced his way of viewing things. But this brings us to a point where maybe we want to stop and discuss for a little bit or ask questions. We're up to 1830 now. The Book of Mormon has been printed. And most of these Books of Mormon have on their one of their first pages a list. There are usually two lists, one with three men's names who claim to have seen the tablets as well as Joseph Smith, and on the other one is a list of eight men's names who evidently at a different time claimed they also saw the plates. But if you know the story, well, once Joseph got done translating the plates, the angel Moroni took the plates back and hid them. And no one knows where the plates are today. So all we have to rely on is this book that looks like the King James Version. It's just an English translation of what is supposed to be an ancient document written before the time of Christ. Gwen, you had your hand up?
Just two questions. Was the angel of Moroni, was that the one from the other planet? Because I know they also, there's something extraterrestrial about their faith too.
Right.
And then also too, when you look at some of their customs in the temple, they coincide a lot with the Masons.
I don't know where the angel Moroni came from. I don't remember reading anything about that. Gwen, when she read somewhere that this was an angel from another planet. She's kind of getting into the teachings of Mormonism now, the doctrines, which, by the way, the book is full of quotations from one of Joseph Smith's other books called Doctrines and Covenants, because that's the book that gives more the teachings. The Book of Mormon gives more the history, the supposed history of what's going on in America. So I don't know if Moroni was one of these angels that was on a different planet or a different universe or whatever you want to call it. I did not really read about that. I was intrigued in my reading this time around that some of the documents that I read did not call Moroni an angel, but called him a human being who has been exalted to a certain point. And the other one was Joseph Smith's connections
with the Mormons that evidently with the Masons, that some Masonic symbols are used within Mormonism. I have heard that too, but I haven't read enough yet to be able to tell you any specifics on that. I don't know. Jim?
What is Latter-day?
Latter-day means in the last days of the Earth's history. See, the Mormons believe that during a whole period of time, the gospel really was lost between Christ and between the time of Joseph Smith. And it's only in these latter days that the gospel has been restored. And so it's these saints living in these latter days who make up this church. One of the teachings we'll be seeing as we learn this is that because that whole period of 1800 years between Jesus and Joseph Smith was, according to them, just a whole period of falling away, they will baptize the dead. They have Mormons who will volunteer. I will be the substitute for so-and-so of my ancestors, and I'll get baptized for them. You could get baptized again and again for certain ancestors. That's why they're so big in the genealogy. Because that's the only way for these people who were lost, who never got to hear the revelation of Joseph Smith. That's the only way for them to be saved. And then in the one thing I read, they're baptized through the substitution, and then once they rise from the dead, then someone can preach the gospel to them, and that will be their opportunity to be saved. Dave, did you have a comment?
Do we know anything about Joseph Smith from a scholarly viewpoint? It would seem like this book, which is critical of so many people, he wrote himself kind of a fraud. How did he get the knowledge or the ability? Do we know anything about his background?
Yeah. In the reading that I have done, he doesn't seem to be a particularly educated person. It seems that his mother was very fervently religious, and she would spend much time with him in discussion. And he must have been very familiar with the Bible, from early things that he said, from things that are in the Book of Mormon. I would think it's very typical of these people in the wilderness of America, in the frontier life of America, where probably the Bible was the only book in the home. And if someone, you know, is interested in reading and that sort of thing, they're going to just treasure that book, and that's going to be the one that they read. But in my reading, I didn't come across anything about a particular education that he got, a particular school that he went to. He seems to be quite a leader from a young time in his life. I mean, just add up those dates once. He was 15 when the revelations began, and if he was born in 1805, by the time he receives the Book of Mormon, he's 22 years old. So, you know, all of this develops when he's young, and it's so influenced by these preachers who are coming with this particular slant on the Christian faith. It's a very clearly Baptist slant, too. I mean, the Mormons are very, very much into you must be immersed in order to be baptized properly. Dave?
It just seems like a giant leap from this kind of exposure to knowing the Bible to writing a 500-page book that is apparently well-written.
Yes. So I wonder how brilliant a person he is. It does seem like quite a bit. He must have had a very bold personality from things that I've read, very penetrating. When he makes the next move, because of all the bad press and everything he got in New York, moved to Ohio, and the way they describe the scene there, he just got down out of the wagon, he went into the first store and talked to the storekeeper and said, I'm a prophet who has arrived from New York and you're one of my chosen ones. And these frontier people, this person was just awed that the prophet came into his store and was going to make him part of this wonderful building of Zion. That is the goal. Yes. Oh, by the way, let me pass this around again. I think everybody's viewing this as just a sign-up for the book. Please, everyone, sign it. This is my only attendance sheet for today. Okay? I don't think everyone signed. Just sign it, don't put any check mark behind it, and then I'll let you just walk away.
Yes? Yeah, just adding to that, I have read before too that he was, prior to this, he was, I don't know, he was kind of a con man, a competence man. He had a business doing lining, looking for water. Mm-hmm.
Again, I'll take us back to the environment. Jesse is saying this was a person who dabbled in things like divining, you know, using one of those sticks and finding water. And he was used to people coming to him for these pseudo-religious purposes. And remember the setting. This is frontier America. At the time of the revolution, religion in America had really hit a low, and especially organized religion. I repeat this again and again in Bible classes too. Let me emphasize for you that the American religious spirit is a very individualistic religious spirit. And it is, America is a country that loves revolution. Nobody ever quite said it as blatantly, but I'm going to say it right now. But the fact that people left Europe to escape established religion and establish places like Plymouth Rock in Massachusetts really set the tone for what America was going to be like. American religion is very much individualistic. It's very much a religion that questions authority. The revolution of America has made all of us, far more than we realize, people who want to do things a different way, don't want to be straddled with all the constraints of organized religion. This is why we have such a multitude of religions in America. This is why one of the most popular sayings about religion in America is each man may worship according to his conscience. Okay? Freedom of religion is a wonderful thing, but when taken to an extreme, it leads to just a whole tattered piece of cloth that it's very hard to get any uniformity in. And you must remember that upstate New York in the 1820s, when that was about the time that the Erie Canal came through, so it's not very well settled yet. This is the frontier where there are not organized schools and things like we are used to. And where superstition often kind of gets intermingled with religion in order to produce something like this. Remember too, I was intrigued as I was reading about him that he comes from the same generation as Abraham Lincoln. Remember how in America you can come up, at least in this period, you can come up from the dirt and kind of make something of yourself, right? If you're fascinated with things like learning and that sort of thing. And all of the institutions are not yet in place. So if somebody steps forth with confidence, people begin to rally around such a person. Right? Wait. See, I think one of the things we've got to get out of our mind in order to think like Mormons is our whole institutional mindset, right? We educate pastors until the age of 26 before we ever let them out to preach to somebody, right? We're refining them, making sure that they, you
know, have the Word of God downright. That's not the kind of setting that Joseph Smith came. There's not universities everywhere and schools everywhere. And we come from an organized way of doing religion, don't we? In something like Lutheranism, there's a strong sense of obeying your elders and following someone who has been okayed by the seminary or whatever. This is a whole environment where anybody who speaks well might be able to stand up in the camp meeting and say something and sway what is being said. Rick. A thing to keep in mind with the Mormons is they do recognize the Bible as inspired scriptures. I didn't bring along my copy of the Book of Mormon, but it has the traditional subtitle, Another Testament of Jesus Christ. So they don't view themselves as something different from Christianity. They are a reformed version of Christianity. How?
Coming up as a teenager, you have to spend 2 years in the field before you could even consider being a minister or speaking from the group. I don't know if there's any other training or not, but I don't think so.
Great. That's another thing to keep in mind. The young people have always been the spokesman, right? After they graduate from high school or whatever it happens to be, they're sent out to do their mission, right? Another thing to keep in mind is that the Mormon Church is not organized like the Lutheran Church, where you have paid pastors and teachers. They don't have trained clergy the way that we do. One of the books I was reading, if I was understanding it properly, in the whole overall structure of the church, which numbers in the millions, there are only 60 people on the payroll. Now that's drastically different than the Roman Catholic Church, or than Lutheran churches, or even Baptist churches, right? We can't assume the structure that we are used to. Wait.
It has to be organized in some way, but in my apartment, there were at least three separate groups of the missionary guys. First of all, their bicycles were not $2 bicycles, okay? Very expensive bicycles. They did have cars. My apartment complex is not an expensive place to live.
Oh, they lived there. They weren't coming to proselytize. They lived.
So they did their missionary work. Their base was there. So, they would get up in the morning, they'd see them on their bikes, at night they'd come in, and on the weekend they'd get into a car and they'd go off somewhere. So to me, I just thought, I always listen to people say, oh, my son is going on a missionary. Please pray for him. It's going to be really hard out there. I'm thinking, that ain't hard. These guys have been pretty good. So, they know that they're not working.
Gwen points out that her impression is that they're not struggling for money. Even these missionaries, they live in a rather nice apartment. Their bikes are rather expensive. But we've got to remember, these are frugal people who are sending these guys out with bikes and not with cars. And from the things I've read, they are not paid for this work. I don't know how they arrange it as far as their living conditions and that sort of thing, but they are frugal people. I mean, you don't build a big city like Salt Lake City out in the desert in the 1800s unless you are very frugal people, very hardworking people. Jerry?
I can tell the families, like if your son goes out, I can tell the families support that son. They pay for them.
Oh, the family pays for it. When somebody goes out on a mission. Jory?
Well, the corporation as a whole, as a business entity, owns quite a few huge businesses.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. As a whole, they're very thriving, right? They own large enterprises. Things like Deseret Industries, is everybody familiar with it? There's one of them on 80 there, on Business 80, just before it links back up with, what's that? Yeah, and they're invested very heavily into big American companies. I think Marriott. I don't know if they still are. Ralston, Purina, Jack in the Box. What's that?
The largest owner of cattle in the country. No sense. That's his line of work.
Yeah, so they are very thriving. And the Book of Mormon, by the way, is filled with prophecies of that. That if you are a faithful person in this new promised land, the Lord will bless you richly. Mm-hmm. Louisa? Really? Louisa wonders if part of it is a front of looking wealthy. She said the bankruptcies are very high in the state of Utah. Okay, let's continue to go along in our timeline here. Joseph Smith did not last long in New York. There were always these detractors that were kind of biting at his heels. And there was a man from one of the other religions that kind of spawned at that time, kind of a connection with the Seventh-day Adventists, who got disillusioned with that group and went up to New York and said to Joseph Smith, "Why don't you come to Ohio where we are?" And he brought over a whole group of this other, you know, just newly, freshly started religion over to Joseph Smith, and the group began to grow quite aggressively to about 1,000 by this time when they moved to Kirtland, Ohio, in the northeastern part of Ohio. And there he wants to make a fresh start. This is where he jumps off the wagon and talks to the first salesman that he sees about how he's the prophet and everything. And he begins to set up a headquarters there. It seems from early on there was this sense of wanting to reestablish a Jerusalem in America. Sometimes the word Zion is used with it. And he thought that this Kirtland, Ohio would be a good place. But as you can see from the timeline, by the time he got the first temple built there in 1836, he was already getting so much opposition that he very quickly moves on from there. Kirtland gets abandoned, and they all keep moving west. They think that there's this constant movement west to try to escape the persecution that they feel they are undergoing. By this time, things like polygamy are beginning to be whispered about, that his revelations seem to be getting farther and farther out there. And so he's forced to leave Ohio. For a while, he had sent a group over to Independence, Missouri, and tried to start a colony there, but that one didn't really work out either, and they got thrown out of Independence. And he joined that group for a little while, but only stayed like a year or so, spent some time in prison even, and then they went eastward a little bit and crossed the Mississippi River and ended up in Illinois in a place that they called Nauvoo. He said it was a Hebrew word for pleasant plantation, I think it was. And so here they were really going to start a colony of their own. They convinced the state of Illinois to let them have the most independent city-state that I've ever heard about in the United States. They were even going to be allowed to raise their own army in this area. And this was going to be their little headquarters, their Zion in America that they were going to build. But again, there is so much, there are riots that begin wherever Joseph Smith is. And eventually he gets blamed for whatever unrest takes place, and they imprison him, and they're going to have him stand trial. I believe it was for rioting, for causing a riot. And during the time, a mob attacks the jailhouse and shoots both him and his brother, and then it becomes a martyr thing, where now they have somebody who has died for this faith. And so often, when a martyr happens, that's when a religion begins really to explode. And at that time, another forceful person by the name of Brigham Young becomes the leader of the group.
And he says, let's really get out of here and get to some place where we can practice our religion as we feel fit.
And they cross the plains, the Rocky Mountains, and they arrive in the Great Salt Lake Valley. And there they finally are able to found their Zion. The only other, that is in 1847. The only other date that I have down there, because I just wanted to look at the early history in this first session, is 1890, when polygamy becomes officially illegal. The Supreme Court of the United States declares that it's illegal according to American laws. And the leaders of the Mormon Church at that time make an official declaration too that polygamy is not to be practiced. Of course, we read in the news, you know, regularly that there are little splinter groups and kind of undercover groups that still believe that polygamy is proper and who do practice polygamy. But it's been over 100 years since the church has officially sanctioned it. Gwen? Could be. Mm-hmm. Gwen seems to remember that it was because they were applying for statehood at the time. Louisa? Yes.
Mm-hmm. And probably about a month later, maybe 2 months later, the FBI's most wanted list now includes that religious leader in Utah. And I have a friend that I work with, his dad, Bishop of Roseville, very high up in the church. He's actually splintered off from the church.
Hmm.
So he was saying that, you know, now that since it's in the mainstream again, the HBOS on the church for Utah gave the okay to go after this guy.
Hmm. Wow. Oh, the church even gave the okay to go after this particular polygamist. Louisa says, it seems like when they're in the spotlight is when they try to make it seem like they're not in favor of polygamy. They sometimes cover it up if they know that it's going on, but if something comes in the media about it, then in this last case, evidently the leaders of the church even kind of fingered the guy who was in favor of it, who was practicing it, and now he's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, huh? That particular polygamist. Any other questions or comments on this latter part of the history of how the church came into being?
I haven't gone much into the doctrines of it because that's what we're going to be doing in the next few weeks. I simply wanted to look at it from the historical perspective.
Where it comes from, the environment it comes out of. I think one of the things you're going to have to keep in mind is as you consider speaking the truth in love to Mormons, is that if you say they are not Christians, you're probably going to help shut the door on them
because they feel very much that they are Christians.
The name of their churches, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And you're going to have to learn how they view Jesus differently than we do, so that you can come giving them the open sign that I want to discuss who Jesus is. I sincerely believe that you believe in Jesus. But now let's talk about who he was, what his purpose was. I saw a hand over here. Hal?
Did you mention anything about him being a seer? They call a seer, right? Or he's in their shining rock and makes his revelations.
Right. Yeah, I did mention the stones, the Urim and the Thummim, right? He believed himself to be a seer. I mean, he used lofty terms, right? A seer, a prophet, a priest in the order of Melchizedek. I don't know if any of you have come from the Hebrews class, but that comes up several times in there. I mean, that's quite a lofty title if you know the Bible.
Fran?
Was there any relationship between Joseph Smith and Brigham Young? How did Brigham Young become such a leader?
I have not read anything about Brigham Young's upbringing, or, you know, was he a child at the time that Joseph Smith was preaching? Is that when he came over? I don't know. I only read things about him after the death of Joseph Smith, so I can't answer that question. By the way, you're probably going to hear me say that more in this class than in the past, because I usually teach a class on scripture, and so I better have the answers for those. But please excuse me if there's any details of Mormonism that I don't know about, because I'm reading all I can, but I'm by no means an expert. Jenny?
Not to skip ahead, but I just wanted a quick question. It says you're ultimately going to be God. Is that true? And then the men, or just the men?
My knowledge is just for the men. Jenny's already peeking ahead to our subject. She gave away my first answer. What is their objective? What is their goal? And she told, so I'll share it with you. If you didn't hear it, it's to become a god. They are very much these days, they are downplaying that. And I understand that if you ask most Mormons, they'll say, no, I wouldn't want that responsibility to be a god. But we'll see some pretty clear things from their writings, from Doctrines and Covenants, that says, yep, it's to become a god. Craig?
I recently saw Mormon families was on television. They have these specials where they allow the cameras to come in and view their holidays with and what have you. And I thought they said in that special that the polygamy helped them achieve the god status in the afterlife.
Yeah.
The more women they have,
yes. One of the goals of becoming a god is that you want to make as many spirit children as possible, and having more than one wife will help you to have more spirit children. Read the chapter. I'm just trying to entice you. Read the chapter for next time to find out what spirit children are. Jason?
This is a little off the subject, and I'm going to really double-tap a little bit. But when we start getting into research on other religions like Mormonism, or even anything else you didn't shoot, doesn't that kind of go against Romans 16, 17, verse 19, you know, stay away from things that we know to be false teachings? And then also, when we start getting into that kind of research, even if it is for the intention of, you know, witnessing these people, how do we keep ourselves from being empty? Because a lot of these religions are very intellectual. You know, you look at it and say, that's pretty good. That's, you know, that's pretty interesting stuff. You know, and I mean, how do you keep yourself from getting sucked into what you before and before?
Excellent caution. I recommended reading the Book of Mormon before going to visit the temple. Do those things with caution, because it... the devil himself masquerades as an angel of light, and he loves coming at people from the religious angle when he wants to seduce them away, right? One of your questions in your worksheet for next time is, who else in Bible times was seduced by this temptation to be like, to become like God? You know, from the very beginning, right? So, you know, when we're doing this, arm yourself with the armor of God. You know, be in scripture yourself. You know, studying what the Bible truly says, so that you're not evil led astray by this kind of sin. Yeah, good caution. Okay, thank you very much. We'll see you next Sunday.